Good morning. Welcome to Housefeld's sixth collective cast. I'm Lucy Rigby and I'm here with Anthony Mayton and Nicola Boyle. Now, last month in our collective cast, we discussed the CPO hearing in Justin Le Patterel's claim against BT, which relates to the alleged charging by BT of excessive prices to approximately 2.3 million BT landline customers. We now have a judgment in that case. It was handed down on Monday. The CAT they dismissed BT's cross application to strike out, and they've granted a collective proceedings order. So that's the second CPO that we've had in opt-out collective proceedings. And this is the first CPO in a standalone claim. I think one of the most remarkable things about this one, or one of the most immediate noteworthy things I should say, is about the speed at which this has reached judgment, Nicola.
Yes, I think, Lucy, compared to the first CPO judgment which we had in Merricks, which obviously took several years to get to an outcome, the claim here was actually only filed in January 2021 with a two-day hearing, which, as you say, covered strikeout and a CPO application in the summer, and we've got a judgment now in September. And I think this is really encouraging because it gets to the point, I think, which is the aim of the rules, that the CPO shouldn't be a very long, drawn-out process and a full mini-trial, but rather a gateway that's established quickly and promptly so that the right cases can proceed. So I think we shall hopefully now see a lot of progress being made across a number of cases. As you say, what we've also seen post the Merricks judgment is defendants now bringing strikeout applications alongside the CPO as another attempt to bring the Merricks assessment into the CPO hearing. But I think it's fair to say, Lucy, as you say, this was dismissed by the tribunal, who I think took quite a robust approach to the attempted strikeout.
Sorry, Anthony, go on.
I was just saying it's very reassuring, I think, from Clement's point of view, because there are quite a lot now of these 102 standalones, and it looks like the tribunal is going to be robust about the way it approaches attempts to get rid of those at early stages. So personally, I'm very encouraged by that.
Yeah, and as you say, Anthony, I think in a standalone, when one of the arguments was, well, you don't have a full infringement decision, they were relying here on a market assessment, and so, but the CAT said, well, yes, that's evidence you can rely on and you'll be able to use in the case. It doesn't matter, as you say, that you don't have a follow-on. So encouraging, I think, from a number of cases perspectives.
In relation to the expert evidence point, because BT had run this argument that the Ofcom report from 2017 that had found that the market wasn't very competitive, and in relation to which BT had then offered this pricing commitment. BT had run an argument to say, well, hang on, no infringement was found, it was just a commitment, but by the way, this report, it's not enough. And I think rightly the CAT said, well, it's certainly enough for now, frankly, which is good. There was also an argument that BT ran in relation to mitigation, saying that these class members had a duty to switch if they were being charged excessive prices, and on that again that the CAT said, well, that there may or may not be an argument on that, but it's certainly not good enough to knock out the claim at this stage.
It's just good to have reaffirmed that the standards for a collective action shouldn't be any different from the standards for a normal.
Exactly, which is there a reasonable case that's plausible.
And if you get over that pressure, and it's very much in tune with Merricks and the Supreme Court in the way they looked at it, but it's good to see the first instance judges effectively enforcing that.
And actually encouraging that you can now flush out a strikeout alongside the CPO in one hearing in 2 days. So I think that will hopefully avoid defendants being able to do
it. Well, I was going to say, hopefully this will discourage defendants from making hopeless strikeout applications as a matter of course. We'll see.
Yeah, Yeah, unless there's a sort of knockout blow, it seems pretty pointless. I mean, so the cats, they go through and dismiss these six arguments that BT make and dismiss the strikeout application. They then move, and this is dealt with in relatively short form, to the question of whether or not the proceedings should be brought on an opt-out or an opt-in basis. And BT had said that this claim is clearly suitable to be an opt-in claim.
Yeah, I mean that always seemed to me a balmy argument, I have to say, because you know, a consumer class, and a very large consumer class, is absolutely the sort of class that you would think everyone would think you should have on an opt-out basis, not on an opt-in basis.
Yeah, and I think it was actually really encouraging the way the tribunal dealt with this, because the argument from BT was, well, we know who, we can identify the class members very easily here from BT's own records, and therefore if they'll have to opt in for the damages at the end, why shouldn't they do that at the beginning of the case? And I think really encouragingly, the tribunal recognised that it's a wholly different proposition for a consumer to assess and opt into a claim which is complex, involves very complex expert evidence, and has a number of risks if you had to sign up to a funding and engagement structure. And so that accepted the reality of that these consumer claims aren't going to be brought on an opt-in basis.
Yeah, and that's very different from simply turning up at the end of the case and putting your application in to get your £30 or £50 or whatever it may be.
Yeah, so I think, that's hopefully again changed the bar on when this question of opt-in, opt-out.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope, wouldn't you, that this argument won't be run again by defendants, certainly in consumer cases. Where they say that it should be done on an opt-in, not opt-out basis.
Yeah.
We will.
So there was one further point that emerged from the judgment, and this is in relation to the cats leaving open the possibility that the defendant could directly credit class members with a share of a damages award, which I think raises some pretty it raises some problems, frankly.
Yeah, I was chairing or co-chairing the GCR competition litigation event yesterday, and we had Adrian Chopin of Benchwalk talking about funding in competition claims, and he mentioned this, which obviously it had come to his attention. And as he rightly said, for a funder, a world in which the class is being paid out 100% leaves nothing for the funder out of the residual from the claim. So you wouldn't, as a funder, want to fund a claim where there's going to be 100% distribution. I mean, it's just the inherent difficulty of the way the regime was set up.
Yeah, and there's a real tension in that, and always has been, that you want a successful claim that compensates consumers, but the only way you can do that is with a funder coming in to support the case. And as you say, Anthony, you need to have a case where there's, you know, substantial consumer benefit, but at the same time that the funder is going to get some return for their investment.
Yeah. I mean, I also have a concern about the idea that the defendant pays out the money to the class. And I think it's slightly odd in a situation where, as I understand it, BT was suggesting they would credit the accounts of those who are in the class. Now, that to me, if damage is to be paid, then damage should be paid. It shouldn't be a credit to an account.
And this is in circumstances, Anthony, where you've got the supplier you've been using found guilty of excessive and unfair pricing. So yeah, the consumer should, quite rightly in that situation, have the right not to have to pay that money back to BT, but to take it and decide whether it wants to move supplier.
Yeah. And from reading the judgment, I wasn't sure that this had been fully argued before the tribunal or not. It seemed a little bit off the fly, and I think it's a point that needs to be fully argued before anyone makes a decision.
Yeah, I think that's right. It was referenced, I think, Lucy, as the rules may allow for this situation in principle, but that wasn't further debated as necessary at this stage.
I mean, it's also, I suspect, a relatively rare occurrence, because it's not often going to be the case where the defendant has the access to to do what BT was proposing, i.e. pay the class out. And if you look at, for example, the Apple, Google claims that, that we're running, I mean, they're not going to have the information, I don't think, in order to make those payments.
And I think one of the things about BT was that one of the issues was that you had a sort of very loyal customer base that hadn't changed and hadn't switched. And so, as you say, it's quite a captive group, and that they would might have the majority of the records. But if you look at a number of other claims, that's certainly not going to be on a comprehensive basis.
Yeah,
I think indeed, in direct claims, this issue won't arise, of course, at all.
Yeah. I think the most, in some ways, the most striking point is the point you make, Anthony, about the company that's behaved unlawfully, giving out to, you know, as recompense for its behaviour, giving out the opportunity to spend more money with the dominant company that's behaved badly. It's pretty counterintuitive.
Yeah, and that would have to be very carefully policed, wouldn't it? Because I mean, how hard do they have to try to pay the money if they can't pay it out very easily, or an account's closed, or I mean, what's the policing of that to make sure that it's properly done? It just seems to me asking the person who has to pay out the sum to be in charge of paying out the sum instinctively doesn't feel right.
And that just shows there's a number of issues still to be worked through as we reach this stage, and and also working out from a funder's perspective it doesn't kill the sort of funding appetite for supporting the claims.
Yes, and going back to the funding point, I mean, I wonder how alive the cat is to this, the reality of this issue, and how it plays through for funders. Mm-hmm.
And there's obviously other ways that you can structure the process as an opt-in. You take a percentage of the damages from, as will happen in many other cases, or you have to have some separate regime where the court in order the costs in order to make it viable.
I mean, it's a dilemma, is it? Of course, you want to get as much money to the class as you possibly can.
Yeah.
Equally, if you get all the money to the class, you're never going to bring the claim because the funder's never going to step up to the plate.
Yeah, intuitively, it's very conflicted.
Yeah. I can see that point is going to be debated much further. But I think, I mean, perhaps putting that point to one side, on balance, this is a pretty good judgment for claimants.
I think it's good news, isn't it? You know, speed, strikeout didn't succeed. The opt-in argument didn't succeed, and I think it should be a very clear pathway for consumer claims to hopefully move along pretty quickly there.
Yeah, so giving clarity to people looking at new cases.
Yeah,
and we've got there are some further CPO judgments awaited in the trains cases, the trucks cases, in relation to FX as well. So no doubt those judgments will be with us soon. And Housvald's 7th collective cast will be coming up next. So that one we're going to be talking about our Google claim that Anthony referred to earlier, and we're going to be talking to our class rep and the champion of consumer rights in the digital space, Liz Cole. So something to look forward to.
Great. All right. Well, thank you for taking us through that, Lucy.
All right. Thanks, both.